more new data coming through.
What's the blowback, Houston?
It's not good. Most of our systems are gone. Debris chain reaction is out of control and rapidly expanding. Multiple satellites are down and they keep on falling.
Define multiple satellites.
Most of them are gone. Telecommunication systems are dead. Expect a communication blackout at any moment.
Kowalski visual of debris, 9 o'clock.
Half of North America just lost their Facebook.
Yeah, it's a kind of a glib throwaway line, that comment. Half of America just lost Facebook. That was George Clooney about to spin out of control with Sandra Bullock in the movie Gravity, when the shuttle they're on is hit by debris as they're orbiting the Earth. Obviously, it's pure fiction, but like a lot of sci-fi movies, it's grounded in some reality. The fact is, modern life has become extraordinarily dependent on telecommunications, which are in turn dependent on the myriad of satellites orbiting the Earth 24 hours a day. Well, apart from space debris, another great threat to these communication satellites comes from the one entity that gives this entire planet life, our sun. It might be 150 million kilometers away, but it's a raging ball of hot gas, and when solar storms erupt on its surface, they have the potential to play havoc with astronauts' communication and navigation systems here on Earth. So to keep us all hooked up to Facebook and all of our favorite social networking sites 24 hours a day, it's important that we have an understanding of exactly how this interference can happen. To that end, the School of Physics at Trinity College has just opened a new teaching and research facility down here in Birr, County Offaly. It's called the Ross Solar Terrestrial Observatory, and to tell us about it, I'm delighted that Dr. Joseph Roach, Trinity College astrophysicist, has come down all the way to Birr today. Thanks very much for coming down, Joseph.
Thanks for having me.
And look, we're going to talk about your new research facility in a moment, and also your intention to be the first or one of the first people on the planet Mars.
We'll
find out
that.
How realistic that is. I definitely want to get to that. But just briefly, there is an entire generation who take global communications for granted. I think their lifestyles would be shattered if they suddenly lost access to their beloved mobile phones and social network sites and the internet. Is it really all under threat from the likes of space debris and solar activity, solar storms, the kind of stuff you're studying?
Well, I think the bigger threat is the likes of the solar storms. So in Gravity, as you said, the space debris is the problem. And we love Gravity. I saw it several times last year. We made it almost an educational outing because there aren't many sci-fi movies that get a lot of the science right, but Gravity does have a lot of wonderful science in it. But the one thing they kind of tweak just to make it more interesting is this idea that space debris could cause some sort of chain reaction and all the satellites get knocked out. And that's probably extremely unlikely because the satellites are in very specific orbits. So that one's less of a danger, but the solar storms is a big one because we have this, as you say, this generation that are dependent on satellites. We've grown up with these satellites. We're used to them being there. We take them for granted, but they are a recent invention, and we've never had to test them with large-scale solar flares, which have occurred historically, but not in the last number of years.
I always get the impression about solar flares. You can probably see them with your radio telescopes. We'll get to radio telescopes in a few minutes. You can probably see them. You can probably understand their effects. But can you actually do anything about it in terms of what they're actually going to do on Earth, what effects they have?
Well, even being able to predict them would be a massive achievement because at the moment, if there is a huge solar flare and it occurs in the direction of Earth, then there are real dangers associated with them. It's not just the satellites, the likes of the astronauts on the International Space Station. If they were able to be warned in advance that they have a couple of minutes to make sure they're inside and protected as much as they can from the radiation, I mean, it has the potential to save lives.
Now, there's a difference between an old-fashioned telescope. We talked about the Leviathan there out in these gardens, which was the biggest telescope in the world for about 70 years in the 19th century. You're in more into radio astronomy, which is... is that you don't send out radio waves, am I right? You detect radio waves coming in with a radio telescope.
Exactly, yeah. So it's basically like
radio waves coming from the sun and elsewhere.
Yeah, you can detect them from across the universe, and tuning into different types of radio waves allows you to hear different things, just like you would with your radio. But you're absolutely right. The idea of a radio telescope is maybe a little different to what we traditionally think of. And even especially the one we're trying to build here in Birr is going to be even more different. I think people are kind of accustomed to the idea of perhaps a large dish that collects information. But the one we're trying to build here is very different from that.
I know they had some, I mean, traditional dishes, aren't they, that look up into the sky using lenses and whatever. And they have some on the Chilean plateaus, the Andes, you know, up on plateaus. And presumably the reason is they got clear skies. We don't have clear skies in Ireland. So why is Birr a great location in particular for a radio telescope?
Well, we don't have the clear skies needed for visual astronomy, but the radio waves that we're detecting, they're not really affected by the weather so much. So cloudy skies aren't going to affect us. The big thing that would cause obstacles to this type of astronomy is radio pollution. So like with light pollution, if you're trying to observe the sky and there's lots of bright lights around you, it's quite difficult. The same is true of radio astronomy. If you're trying to listen in to stars or the sun, and there's a lot of radio interference, it can be quite tricky. But thankfully in Ireland, we're beside an ocean and we don't actually output much radio waves ourselves. So when they surveyed Birr here, they found that it was one of the best places in the world for radio astronomy. So even places in the Sahara are not as good in terms of radio pollution. Birr is just extremely radio quiet, and we should capitalise on that.
And Richard and Aina and Terry are all on the panel with me, and they're all itching.
To ask you about the solar flares, because you were speaking of them as if everybody knew what they were. You were saying we've had them before, we've been able to detect them. So how frequently have they occurred before? What exactly are they and what do they do?
Sure. Well, they're basically massive eruptions that occur on the surface of the sun. So obviously, no one should ever look directly at the sun, but we have our idea of what the sun looks like. It's this ball of hot gas in the sky. But really, when you study it and look at it in different ways in terms of the amount of radiation coming from it, it's a very, very active star. And sometimes it's more active than others. At the moment, it's quite quiet, but throughout history, there's examples of when the sun became very active, extremely violent, and a lot of solar flares occurred. And these solar flares are basically, it's all to do with the magnetic fields on the sun. These magnetic fields, they get wound up, they get tight and coiled, and then they basically explode and release a lot of particles, a lot of radiation, and sometimes they can take place in the direction of the Earth. And we have examples of in history, they've had enough power to knock out power grids in Canada, for example. There was a blackout caused by a solar flare. But we haven't had a really big one in quite a while. So that's why, in terms of our newfound dependence on satellites, it's very important for us to understand what would happen if a massive solar flare occurred and had the potential to damage our satellites.
And to be able to forecast the likelihood of it about to happen.
Yeah, and that's the big area of research at the moment, is studying the different different types of radiation coming from the sun, studying the sunspots, which are cooler parts of the sun, which might be an example of something that that occurs before a solar flare. So we're trying to figure out if there's a pattern and if there's a way of predicting these things.
People who suffer from indigestion will understand this extremely well. Reflux, belching, the sun bursts open. Now, I remember, if you go back to the Cold War, I lived through the Cold War, telecommunications engineers were very worried about a thing called the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse. The idea was that if you detonated a nuclear weapon, there would be a massive double electromagnetic shockwave pulse transmission sent out, and that would burn up, destroy all the, particularly the transistor-based equipment as it was then, chips and everything would be destroyed and everything would go dead. Now, presumably the sun is doing much, it's belching, and a million kilometres into the air goes this massive burst of protons and particles of all kinds and radiation, and all this muck comes whizzing down and clobbers satellites and aircraft and everything else. And this is the fear. Now, what do we hope to be able to do in the face of such an onslaught if it comes?
Well, I think obviously predicting it is the first step, but once we understand it a bit better, we can develop our satellites, develop our instruments so that they're not affected by it. And one of the big things is the interference is something that we would struggle with. So even the likes of airplanes, I know they're in the news a lot at the moment, and airplanes are extremely dependent on their instruments and getting correct readings. And if the sun is very active, at the moment we always advise that if there's airplanes, if they shouldn't fly over the poles in periods of high activity, because the Earth is lucky we have this magnetic field that protects us from a lot of the interference from the sun. But if you're flying close to the pole, that's a kind of a gap in our magnetic field where maybe some activity from the sun could cause interference to the airplane. So it's an effort for us to not just understand when and how these occurrences happen on the sun, but also to better understand how we can future-proof our devices so that they won't be in jeopardy or in danger if there is a large solar flare.
Joseph, can I ask, the particles that actually might interfere with communications technology, those kind of whatever tiny minuscule particles that are flying towards us, surely they're travelling at the same speed as the radio waves with which we can detect them. So by the time we know about them, they'll be here. Is that not a kind of a problem?
Well, yes. Yeah, so when they're here, they're already causing the damage. Yeah. Exactly. And that's why we study things like sunspots, which could occur on the sun maybe days, possibly even weeks, months in advance, and warn us if there's a particular region of the sun that is looking like it might become more active and might have a greater chance of an eruption taking place and of a solar flare occurring.
Joseph, just following on there from Olin's point, is it actually these emissions, is it a form of matter or is it a form of energy? Because surely if one was matter and one was energy, they'd be travelling at different speeds.
Well, it's at this temperature, this energy, they're almost interchangeable. So you will get both. The plasma is thrown out into space, there's matter, there's energy, and they do travel at different speeds. So different things impact the Earth at different times. So anything that's moving at the speed of light will arrive in a number of minutes, but we will have other material arriving later. So
will they do different forms of damage then?
They could, yeah, exactly, yeah. So the type of interference they cause is quite different. That's why we need to monitor it across the whole spectrum. It's not just a question of monitoring individual. That's why we have things like radio telescopes, because we want to make sure we have each different type of radiation and all the different types of particles and matter that go with it completely monitored.
So Joseph, you mentioned future-proofing specifically. What does that mean? What are you actually going to do?
Well, at the moment, we're very used to radio communication for on this planet in particular and using satellites. But I think if we find out that solar flares are confined to a particular region that will interfere with our satellites and our telecommunication systems, then I think we'll design satellites in future that just don't need to use that particular
bandwidth. Oh, I see, yeah.
We'll ignore it. We'll leave that for the sun and we'll stick to other communication.
But the first goal is understanding, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
So this radio telescope then that you're organising in Birr is part of a European network, is it, of radio telescopes? Are they like one huge big one, or are they separate ones all talking to each other?
Well, the interesting thing is it's kind of both, and that's why I think it's a kind of new idea of what a radio telescope should look like. So I think we often think of them as dishes, and if you think of a big radio dish, it's easy to picture it collecting information. But with the type of radio waves we're looking at, we don't actually need it to be one complete dish. It's almost like you can take different parts of the dish, spread it out, and it'll still work even if there's gaps in between it. So at the moment, the LOFAR network is a network of these type of telescopes. Even though they're all across Europe, they still collect information based on the complete area that they cover. And that's why Ireland is so pivotal to a network like that, because we're the furthest point. So by having Ireland a part of that network, the whole effective dish size becomes even bigger. And
so they're in a circle around the Netherlands at the moment, are they?
It's not quite a circle. It's more of a spiral pattern, but the majority of them are in the likes of the Netherlands and Germany. And having more of them does improve the sensitivity, but the real big thing is having one further out. And that's why Ireland is so key to getting into that network.
Now, these are the LOFAR, the LOFAR, are they? You've opened one observatory and educational facility down here that involves radio telescopes, but there's a separate project, am I right, called LOFAR, which is, let me get it right, Low Frequency Array. I don't want you to be too technical, but explain roughly what LOFAR is.
Sure, so at the moment we have some instruments in Birr already that monitor radio waves, but they're good and they serve their purpose, but really we have an opportunity in Ireland with the amazing geographical location we have here, the fact that it's so radio quiet, to not just be another bit part player in radio astronomy. We have an opportunity to be a world leader, And that's why low far is it just makes sense for us, because if we build that radio telescope here, not only are we all of a sudden taking part in a Europe-wide mission to understand the sun, and even, I mean, it's not just the sun, I mean, that's our particular area of interest, but with something like LOFAR, you're looking at radio waves from across the universe. Mm. And the really interesting thing is you can look at radio waves that also almost go back in time. They're so far away that it's like you're looking at the early universe.
Camille, we opened up with a clip of Gravity.
Yes.
I could have picked any of a number of movies about Mars, including Mission to Mars, or what's the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger? I can't remember.
Total Recall.
Total Recall. Oh, you've probably watched them all, haven't you?
Not all of them, no. It's amazing. Whenever I talk about it, everyone seems to have another movie to recommend that I haven't seen. So.
I bet you they pick holes and they say, tell us about what's wrong with this movie and what's wrong with that movie. But you're on a shortlist to be the first person to go to Mars. Tell us about that.
On a one-way ticket.
We'll miss you.
You wouldn't be coming back. Tell us more.
Who's going to protect us from our Facebook going down or our Twitter's going down if you go away?
Well, you guys will give me the advance warning. The sun will hit you guys before it hits us if we're on Mars. So we'll have a couple of minutes extra.
Tell us about Mars anyway.
Well, Mars is it's an interesting one, because it seems like all of a sudden this has come up that we're talking about sending people to Mars. But really, we've had the technical capability to send things to Mars for a while. We've gotten better at that with the likes of the rovers being sent to Mars. But the reason we're suddenly talking about manned missions is because there's been an obstacle for a number of years, and that we don't know how to do the return trip. It's all fine sending something to Mars and landing it safely, but because Mars has some gravity, not as much as Earth, but it does have gravity, you'd have to have a launch on Mars, and trying to launch from a different planet to arrive safely back at Earth is just a technical challenge we haven't figured out yet. And that's where Mars One came in. They're a not-for-profit organization in the Netherlands, and they decided they wanted to get involved in space exploration. And their big innovation was to decide, instead of trying to solve this technical challenge of the return trip, why not just get rid of that obstacle altogether? Why not just remove it from the equation and instead have an open call looking for volunteers that would go to Mars and be happy to live out the rest of their days there?
And you're one of them.
Yeah, so in 2013 they opened the call, and 200,000 people from around the world applied. The only constraints were that you had to be older than 18 years of age and younger than 82. And then at the turn of the year, they cut it down to 1,000, just over 1,000 people.
But how long, say if you're 81 years of age and you're chosen, how long would it take to get you to Mars?
Well, they're hoping to launch in about 10 years' time.
How long was the journey?
The journey itself.
Well, I'm kind of thinking of, like, one of the things space travel is trying to teach us about effects on bone density, for example. And surely that's one of the effects, like bone density with age. And
Absolutely.
How would that affect somebody?
But how long does the journey take to go there?
So it'll take us 7 months. So it's comparable to the amount of time the astronauts spend in the International Space Station. And we know from their studies that bone density, muscle mass, they do decrease rapidly in low gravity environments. So when you take away gravity, your body starts to deteriorate. And it's one thing being able to do the exercise. I mean, on the International Space Station, you spend 3 hours a day doing exercise. But even still, when you come back to Earth, it takes them almost as long as they've been on the space station to recover. So the body.
So it makes much more sense to send old people then, because their length of time they're left on Mars is much shorter than a young man like yourself who could be there for 50 years. I'm not going to go. No,
I'm looking at a few notes here. I'm looking at a few notes here. It says people will be selected on people have to be between 18 and 82, as you say, of sound mind and body. People would argue that if you're going to go, you're not of sound mind. But they have to. They're initially assessed on knowledge, intelligence, adaptability, and personality. Why would you say personality is a factor? Because apparently, personality is important. Because Mars One has a unique funding model that might include a reality TV show. So, as part of me going to Mars, you might be a reality TV star, Joseph.
A reality show. I think I'd say it all.
I think that's the point.
Big Brother does Mars.
Exactly. Yeah. People do start to think it sounds a bit ridiculous when you bring in the reality TV component. And I mean, it does sound ridiculous, but the thing is, with any new venture into space exploration and any new attempt at revising funding models and trying to fund it in new ways, it's always going to seem crazy at the start. And it might be crazy. It might turn out to be the complete wrong direction to go. It might fail spectacularly. But I think it's still worth investigating and to see if this is a viable route to go.
How realistic?
So you live up there in something like a Nissan hut in size for the rest of your days.
You can work out how to get home.
Well, you're never going to get home. I mean, that's a huge task. That would take ages to develop. You're going to be up there with how many individuals and all day long? There are no days and nights up there, at least not in our sense of the term. So it's a completely different ballgame. Will you not despair? You'll get sick. You'll have all kinds of symptoms. Are you going to carry a suicide suicide needle or something for when things get too bad, you give yourself a shot or swallow cyanide? Or what are you going to do about boredom? What are you going to do about changing your mind?
There's a load of questions there. I'll start with them. If I forget one of them, you can bring me back to it. But first of all, the reason Mars is... It's suitable in some sense. I mean, on one hand, it's a cold, dead planet. It's not the most hospitable place, but it does have day and night similar to Earth. So that's actually a big thing because the human body is so well adjusted to day and night that it's good for us to stick to something that's similar. It's 7 months to get there in a very small spacecraft, but when we get there, the habitat they're devising is quite big. So it's about the size of a football pitch, and the reason for that is because. The spacesuits that we would wear on Mars would protect us from some of the radiation, but not entirely. So they know that you probably reach the recommended radiation dosage in about a couple of hours per week. So you'd have to spend most of your time indoors. But the facilities they're devising are such that you would live on Mars as a scientist, collaborating with the scientists here on Earth. So it'd be like being confined to a research institute, which a lot of scientists already have to do here.
Now, I heard Leo Enright recently talking about this, and he said that the first person to go to Mars is most likely in creche right now. So I'm not going to ask your age, but you're a doctor at Trinity College, so you're not in creche. How realistic do you think it all is?
Leo is an expert in this area, and I think if you ask people in NASA, they would absolutely agree with him. At the moment, if we look at our traditional ways of funding space missions and the level of progress, it would seem like the obvious people to get to Mars will be NASA, and their plans are 30 years down the line, which realistically means it could be 40 or 50 years.
Mm. We can all practice by going to the moon first.
Well, the moon is 4 days away, and it doesn't really give us a whole lot of information. I still think we should go back to the moon. There's a lot to be learned, but Mars is a different planet. There's no gravity on the moon. There's
no atmosphere, no place for a party.
No. In terms of whether I agree that it's someone in creche now that's probably going to go to Mars, I would have to say, as a scientist, probably that's probably true. But I still think it's worth pursuing something like this.
Listen, before we go, you're taking part this weekend in the Festival of Curiosity in Dublin. We're down in Birr, celebrating Birr, but there's a lot going on in Dublin this weekend for anybody interested in science.
Yeah, and not just Dublin, it's in Cork now as well. So the Festival of Curiosity is in its second year now, and it just really excites me because. There's events across Dublin and Cork about different areas of science or interest, and they sell out, which is incredible. Having scientists speaking about things that they find curious, and having the Irish public booking out those events in advance. I mean, it's.
And you were at something with Dara O'Brien last night.
That's right. Yeah, we had an event called Curious Science in the Mansion House. So Dara O'Brien was talking to a few different scientists about what we find interesting and curious, and hopefully the audience thought so as well. But
because he was a theoretical physicist in another life.
Yeah,
Dara was.
I think he still is. I think once you're a theoretical physicist, you're always a theoretical physicist.
But he's also a stand-up comedian, and he's a busy man because he's playing in the Ivy Gardens tonight. He's doing the Ivy Gardens Vodafone Comedy Festival that's happening all this weekend. So he's gone straight from science to the to Ivy Garden to do a set tonight.
Yeah, so he's a multi-talented man.
We might try to get back and go to that. Listen, Joseph, thanks a million. Can we monitor your progress? Will you come back in and tell us how...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I'm earthbound for at least 10 years. So,
at least 10 years.
You're down to the last 40. Can tell us.
Just before you go, you're down to the last what right now?
Sorry, yeah, so there's
200,000 people applying.
200,000. It got cut to 1,000 just before Christmas, and then we all had to do medical tests, and we started like a psychological test just to see if we're suitable. And from that, they've picked 705 of us, and they're planning on interviewing all of us over the next year and a half. So they'll cut us down to a group of maybe 20 or 40 in the next year and a half. And when they get there, that's when the astronaut training starts.
Well, Joseph Roach, astrophysicist, Mars explorer, thanks a million for coming down to Birr. Best of luck with the observatory as well, and the whole LOFAR observatory across Europe. Thanks very much for coming in.